Welcome back to the podcast. I am your BFFF. You know what that stands for, Chris?
Big best friend for finance.
Best financial friend forever.
That's close.
That's not bad, is it? And
do you hand out the little broken heart necklaces where we all just get a half of it?
No. No. But now you gave me an idea that would be a pretty good promotional piece I should do. But I digress. As you can see, this is going to be a completely serious topic we're going to talk about. But look, I know all you owners out there, all you business owners out there, you guys are always talking to me about creating passive income. Everybody always wants passive income. And it usually leads into talking about real estate and, you know, like real estate's just this one big blob and there are different component parts of that. So I wanted to bring on someone that I actually trust when it comes to real estate, someone that's actually been in the industry for a number of years, and someone that I think has a very high acumen in this area. I'm giving him a lot. Not only that, but he's got like the best hair in the business as well. So I don't know any other way to introduce him. He works for, he's a chief investment officer for Reliant Investments, which is one of the largest storage operators in the country. I don't know how much in assets you guys manage at this point in time. I'm sure it's in the hundreds and hundreds of millions, if not billions at this point. But we're going to talk about real estate. I want to talk to him about the current state of real estate, because I think a lot of people are a little nervous about what's happening here and, you know, what's going to happen if interest rates go up more or they come down, and how's that going to affect, you know, my investment into this area. And then I want to talk about, you know, do-it-yourselfers versus hiring someone like Chris's firm to actually help you with investing in this area and, you know, their process for selecting property. So, you know, we'll have a ton to talk about, but welcome, my friend. And let's get started on the current state of affairs. So look, you know, we'll start with commercial real estate, because I think is it a safe thing to say that commercial real estate right now in certain areas is a troubled asset class?
I think that the nuance is in specific areas, right? Look, the asset classes in commercial real estate are broad. You know, you got multifamily and self storage and industrial and office and commercial retail. And then there's a whole bunch of little nichey ones after that. I mean, what I would say is I think office has garnered most of the headlines, right? Mm-hmm. And it's a scary time for office operators because of the work from home transition. But, you know, you got to understand that the media is built to create clicks and they want eyeballs. And so, you know, the news cycle we've heard in the last 3 months in real estate has been this mountain of debt that is maturing in the next 12 to 18 months, and it's going to implode the banking system. Well, yes, there's debt maturing, but not all of it is short-term debt going from 3% interest to 7% interest. Like, there's loans in there that, you know, were underwritten or they took out in 2013 and we're 10 years in, right? And those properties are going to crush it. So I think you just have to temper expectations, what you read in the media. There are certainly properties I think that people are going to have trouble with, and it's happening now. Interest rates have gone up in the last 18 months to essentially double, right? Stuff that we were buying in 2020, 2021 at 3% interest rate, now that's at sevens, right? So you're buying at a different debt service. So I think you just need to be thoughtful of, you hear this broad statement of commercial real estate is in trouble. I mean, we're happy for people to think that because there'll be other opportunities, but it's like almost anything, it's not true and block.
Right. I totally get that. And, you know, I say that because people that we deal with, obviously in the healthcare space, and, you know, when you have a private practice, I think one of the best things that they can do is actually own their own building and at some point in time acquire that building. I'm hearing a lot of people right now saying, well, you know, I mean, the interest rates are too high. And, you know, do you have any insight on what we tell, you know, healthcare professionals when it comes to buying a piece of real estate, like what their practice building would be? You know, I don't think there's ever a right time to do it, right? But, you know, certainly there are some things that they could probably look out for. What are some things that, you know, someone that's not like a professional real estate investor like you are, right? Like if I want to open up a veterinary practice and I want to buy this building. Like what would you tell that person?
I mean, the first thing I would say is go get a professional to help you underwrite it, right? Yeah. Find somebody who is in the space that can help you run numbers. Because Eric, you're right. Like interest rates are high relative to the last 2 years or 5 years, but relative to history, they're not. And they're going to normalize somewhere in this 5-6% range, which still feels high to you and me who saw, you know, my mortgage, I have a mortgage on my primary residence that's sub 3%. Mm-hmm. Right. So is 6% high? Yeah. My dad's first house that he bought was at 14%.
Right.
So relative to that, it's not. I mean, I think we normalize at around that 5-ish, 6-ish%, which is kind of where we are. We've just had these anomalies over the last few years. So if you're a physician or somebody in the medical space looking to buy a medical office building, find someone who can help you underwrite that deal. Because the risk in those deals, right, is the tenant.
Yes.
And the build out that goes along with the tenant. If you're the tenant, no one understands that risk better than you do, you know, as far as what revenues are you going to be comfortable paying yourself rent. There's incredible tax efficiencies in having a business that you own paying for real estate that you own. There's an incredible amount of tax efficiency you can create there that you can probably talk more to your clients about. But my encouragement always is to, you know, find someone who can help and move that process along. Because, you know, the other thing to think about is let's say today you get a mortgage at 7% and you can make the deal work, right? At 7% interest rate, you know, you feel like you can pay that debt service down and things are going great. And, you know, if you believe that 3 or 4 years from now, maybe interest rates are lower, maybe it's 5%. I don't think we're going to, in our life cycle, I don't think we're going to be back at kind of the 2s and 3s. But right. If you get down to 5 and you can refinance that deal at a 5% interest rate, then your cash flows become very attractive. So, you know, I think what we all run into, Eric, is we look at the right now, like, this is what is happening and it will never change. Well, everything in real estate is a good deal in 20 years. Everything. Mm-hmm. Right. So if you can look with a little bit longer term view as to we're in a cycle, but that cycle is going to change and everything that's happened in or everything that's going to happen in the future has happened before, right? Like everything is cyclical. And my opinion is we're kind of, you know, we're dipping into the bottom in the next 3 to 5 years. We're probably going to have a pretty nice run, you know, starting at the end of this year into 2025, I think.
Okay. But
just don't say like, okay, today interest rates are high. I can't do anything in the market.
Yeah. Just put like a self-imposed stop there that doesn't need to be there. You can figure a way out of that. I do want to talk to you about the tax benefits too, because, you know, anyone that owns a piece of real estate, there are certainly some tax benefits. I'm obviously you've heard the term cost segregation or accelerated depreciation. Can you keep that simple in talking to, you know, healthcare owners? And I'm not, you know, they're smart people, but you know, these are financial terms. I think they understand the depreciation expense. They see that, but why is it that real estate professionals like yourself, why is it that you guys take advantage of the accelerated depreciation? And is that something like that someone that owns their own building, can they do that as well to help offset some taxable income that they have from their businesses?
Yeah, it's a great question. So,
and by the way, I'll preface this in saying that I know that you are not a CPA, nor are you giving any tax advice right now. How about that?
Perfect, because that was going to be the first sentence that I said. I am not a tax advisor. And if you talk to my tax guy, he would laugh and say the same thing. But I feel like I have good ideas sometimes, whether they're legal or not. That's up to him to figure out. Well, let's start, Eric, just quick high level depreciation. I know you said most people understand it, but all depreciation is the IRS says look, you buy a building and we know that everything, it has a depreciable life. So each year, stuff in your building is worth less. So a roof brand new and a roof a year old, the roof a year old is worth less money. And so typically there's a schedule of 37 and a half years that the IRS says from year one to year 37 and a half, you can depreciate the value of your building every year. And then in year 37 and a half, it's worth $0, mm-hmm. right? Well, there's advantages to, you mentioned the term cost segregation study, where there are certain things in your buildings that the IRS says, hey, we know that's not going to last 37 and a half years, like landscaping, asphalt, specific utilities or infrastructure in your building. And there are firms called engineering firms that will come out and say, all right, Eric, you own this building, you know, your asphalt is worth X. And they allow you to pull that depreciation into a shorter schedule than the 37 and a half years. So, you know, some things might be depreciable in 1 year, five mm-hmm. years. And what it does is in the ownership, you can pull that loss forward in your ownership. And what it does is from an IRS standpoint, you can show that loss against the income the property produces. Now, there's some nuance here. If you own the building, that's great. You can offset the income the building produces. If you are an investor in the building and you are not necessarily an active investor, there's some rules on when you can use that depreciation. There's something called passive income and active income. Mm-hmm. Most healthcare professionals themselves would not be able to qualify for something called a real estate professional, which in my opinion is sort of the golden egg. A real estate professional designation, and you can go online and Google it, there's a test you have to follow, allows you to take passive losses, so depreciation from passive investments,
right,
and offset active income. So like Eric, if you and I were married, it's 2023, nothing wrong with that. If you are a doctor, you're the doctor in our relationship, okay, and I am your husband, and I am a real estate professional. You designate me as real estate professional because all I do is manage all of our real estate investments.
Mm-hmm.
Your W-2 earnings, we can now offset with my passive losses, right? So if you're the big high income earner, you can use losses from passive real estate investments to offset that income, which is a huge benefit. Now,
yes,
here's what I would say. You can pull all that depreciation forward, but it's not free. The IRS doesn't forget that they gave you that loss. So if it's your own building and you plan to hold it forever, I own some apartments in New York where my basis in those apartments is negative. Mm-hmm. Like literally, if I sell it, the IRS sees a negative basis. So whatever my gain is, it's going to be a lot of gain because I've depreciated all the value out of the asset. Well, when you sell, there's something called depreciation recapture, which is taxed at ordinary income. So for a high income earner, that could be 30, 40%. So don't go into depreciation lightly. There has to be a strategy for the back end if you're going to trade out of the asset. Because we get that a lot from our investors, Eric. It's like, oh, I want cost seg, I want the losses. Okay, we can give them to you. But on the back end, when we sell, the IRS is going to say, okay, you know, Eric, you took $10,000 a loss on this property.
Mm-hmm.
That $10,000 is coming back and we're going to tax it at ordinary income. So you got to have something that's going to offset that tax liability somewhere else. So it's always, you know, I think of it like a merry-go-round. If you start taking tax advantages, you have to continue that strategy because when it comes back around, you're going to get taxed eventually. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes total sense. Except all the whole thing makes sense except the part where you and I were married. So, I'm still trying to reconcile that right now, but,
Fair. You were the high income earner.
So, you know, a lot of, healthcare owners get pitched, apartments, right? They get pitched all kinds of things. Anything in the apartment in the multifamily right now that you think would be the opportunities, you know, just like in this area, And it's going to go into my next question, you know, more so, but I'm just trying to get the current state of affairs in some of these different areas. And maybe you can just talk about that between, you know, apartments and self-storage, like current state of those two areas at this point.
So, Eric, are you saying relative to passive opportunities for investors?
Yeah.
When I think about passive investment opportunities, let's take one more step back from the asset class. And what I like to think about is team and track record. It doesn't matter what you're investing in, but I want to meet the people, because when you do these passive deals, you're investing in the team, right? And that team is going to determine the outcome of the investment. And so I like to meet the people, because stuff goes wrong and I just want to know you're good human beings. If you're a bad human and you have a great deal, it's probably not going to turn out okay. Right. And I think that's the big level set. So what I would encourage is anybody looking at passive investments, do your due diligence on the people behind it. Don't be afraid to ask for a background check. You know, Google them. You're shocked at what you find when you just Google somebody's name and the word fraud or theft or something. So I would start with the people and then understand the track record of what they've done relative to what they are pitching you. So Eric, if I came to you and said, hey, we're doing apartments in Tampa, Florida. And you said, well, how many apartments have you done in Tampa, Florida? And I said, zero. You know, that's a red flag where you, I'm not saying we're not a savvy operator, but we do sell storage every day. What makes us an expert at apartments in Tampa? I mean, maybe the answer is we hired a guy who's been doing apartments in Tampa for 10 years, but you want to understand the track record for what it is you're being sold. And for me, those are the two big pillars. And then I go to, do I like the story of the asset class? Mm-hmm. And you mentioned apartments right now. I think there are opportunities everywhere, and good operators are going to underwrite good deals because they don't want a crappy deal on their portfolio either. So I don't think we can paint with such a broad stroke to say, like, look, all of office is bad. That's not right. True. All of apartments are in trouble. There are certain people or certain deals that are in trouble for a myriad of reasons, but I think there's still good opportunities out there, which usually are predicated by finding great operators. And the easiest way we can do it, right, is reach out to your networks and see who has invested, right, with those people. And I think for me, at least, that's been a big, big help is, you know, if I know four or five guys who've been with a group for 5 years, you know, generally that's a pretty good checkbox on the, are they safe and is it not a Ponzi scheme?
Yeah. And I say this because unfortunately I've had a number of clients who, you know, against my advice, invested with some of these, you know, it's these groups that just pop up. Like, I've never heard of them before. And, you know, all of a sudden they're professional, you know, real estate investors, and they're great salespeople, and they're able to, you know, raise money. And, you know, of course they bought these projects or put together these projects or these funds. And now all of a sudden, you know, there was one group, I won't mention them, but they went completely bankrupt. And I had clients that probably lost, you know, probably close to $1 million. Number one, because they tried to do everything. That was one of the things I've always appreciated about Reliant, is you guys just kind of stuck to what you know and didn't get into condos and high rises and other areas. You know, you were like, this is what we know. And then yeah, another one that just, that affected a client of mine. And, you know, again, he's probably going to lose, but what happened to these groups? What did they do wrong? When, yeah. I mean, I know they bought at low interest rates, were extremely low. They probably overpaid for the property. They probably had not much equity in there. You know, maybe talk a little bit about like that. So, you know, if there was a rise in interest rates, it was just going to crush them. Is that all that happened?
I mean, each situation's different, right? But there's an adage in real estate, debt kills, right? I mean, over-levering usually is the root of all issue. And when you're over-levered, and you have, right? Think about this, Eric, like the last 10 years prior to 2023, real estate has just done this. Right. So values have, and for those people not watching, I'm holding my hand in an upward hockey stick type trajectory. It's just gone up. So there's been a lot of geniuses in the market, right? Everybody's made money. And I think, you know, you have to think back to 2009, 10, 11, 12. There were properties that lost 70% of their value in a 2-year period. Well, if you're not underwriting for some level of variability there, I'm not saying you have to underwrite to 70% loss because no deals work. But you have to have some sensitivity analysis in there to say, okay, if it doesn't continue the way that we want in rent growth or occupancy or whatever the case may be, can we sustain this? And what's happened in the last 2 years, Eric, is you've kind of had a double whammy. Interest rates have doubled. So if you had debt coming due, right, and let's say, you know, your debt service, your costs to cover your debt were $100. Mm-hmm. Well, now they're $200. And if you don't have the cash flow to cover that, if you have a loan coming due, right? Like let's say you were end of 2022, your loan was coming due in your apartment complex. You were probably going from 3% interest to 7% interest. So now your $100 a month in debt costs you $215 a month in debt. And if your property can't cover that debt service, you're kind of stuck, right? And you don't have the value in the property yet to sell it. Sometimes you do. But if you've over-levered and you sell it, we've also had a correction in the values as interest rates have risen. So debt costs have gone up. Values have come down arguably somewhere in the 15 to 20% range. So now you got this double whammy for operators where if they didn't execute on their strategy, they can't go out and get more debt because their property isn't worth what they thought it was going to be. Mm-hmm. And they can't pay their debt service because now the debt service is double. And that could be because your loan came due or you signed up for a variable rate loan, which is just following the market, right? And so, you know, each situation's different, but I think right now, and I've heard of at least 3 or 4 deals where investors are getting back 25 cents on the dollar or less, right? Yep. They put $100,000 in and the deal's going upside down, the bank's going to sell it and they're going to get $25,000 back. In those situations, it's been because of the debt, you know, the debt is maturing and they don't have the value to either refinance or cover the debt service moving forward. So I think that's one thing you want to understand is like in our most recent fund, Eric, we're 55% loan to value. And that's been forced upon us by the lenders.
And maybe explain that just for like what the loan to value means.
Sure. If we think of it like you bought your house, when if you were to go out and buy a house, generally the bank wants 20% down, depends on the loan. But you know, if you buy a $100,000 house, 80 of it is coming from debt and $20,000 is coming out of your pocket. Mm-hmm. In our world, it's the same thing. If we buy a $10 million property, I would say in normal or 2 years ago, $6.5 million would have come from debt and $3.5 would come from equity. And in our case, that's investors. Well, now banks have pulled back and said, we're not going to lend you 6.5 anymore. We're going to lend you 5.5. So the bank is safer. So we're coming in with $4.5 million of equity. The bank's coming in with 5.5. So we have 45% equity day one in our loan. There's a lot of cushion there.
Yes, so for sure.
I think you got to think about as you're looking at these deals with other operators, where are they levered? And is there a big chunk of fluff there where, you know, in our particular deal, you got 45% of value that we can essentially lose before the bank gets in trouble. Now, I don't think that's going to happen, but I'd much rather be on the conservative side of that than the aggressive. And that affects returns too, right? That if you got less debt is less expensive than equity. So your returns come down, but you're safer.
And does that requirement of loan to value vary from particular types of real estate? I mean, is that different for apartment complexes that it is for self-storage, or is it pretty much the same?
It can be. It's very lender specific. In apartments, there's something called Fannie and Freddie Mac, which is called agency debt. It's backed by the federal government. In self-storage, we don't have that. Usually Freddie and Fannie are pretty aggressive because the lenders know if the loan goes belly up, the Fed is going to kick in and help them. So they're willing to be a little bit riskier, have larger loan to values. I would say today, though, kind of that 55 to 60% loan to value, most banks are comfortable there because they're trying to protect their collateral, right? They know that if we buy a $10 million property and day one, it's worth 10 million bucks, for them to lose money, we got to lose 40% of the value. Then they sell it. Now it's worth 6 million. They still get all their money back.
Yeah.
So lenders have pulled back, especially after the Silicon Valley Bank crisis, as the market got a little scarier, lenders have pulled back to be more conservative for sure.
Okay. You kind of touched on the due diligence of the operator a little bit. And I think you had mentioned that number one, you have the team, and I agree with you 100%. Like, you have to know the people that are running the organization. Like, you have to trust the operator, because in most of these deal structures, anyone that would invest with, let's say, Reliant or some other group, you're going to be invested as a limited partner. And which basically means that, you know, you're shielded for some of the liability, but you don't have any say over the operations at all. And I'm okay with that. I mean, this is why we would hire an operator, is because I don't want to do it myself. I mean, you guys knows what you're doing. And, are there any, and then I think the other thing that you had mentioned is that does the story make sense? Like the type of real estate that you're going to invest in, does that make sense? And that always drew me to self-storage, because I was one of those guys where, you know, you go up the street and you would see everybody's garage and it was just packed full of crap. And you're just like, my God, human beings just don't throw a friggin' thing away, do they? And like, self-storage cannot go anywhere but up because of this. But I don't know, maybe what your take on self-storage and why you like it so much as an asset class as well.
Yeah, I mean, to your story question, it's hard because things happen in the world, right? Like, COVID happens. Eric, you could have been the greatest hotel operator in the history of the world. COVID happens and you have no more revenue. And it's not because you're a bad operator. It's just the world has shifted. And even if you like the hotel story, you had a little bit of a rough go there, right? And I'm not saying there aren't opportunities, but that's where it falls back to being a great operator. A great operator is going to work their way through it and probably come out on the other side better for it. You know, in our asset class, back to the why self-storage, it's historically been very recession resilient. It's done well in economic downturns because people generally have transition in their lives in economic downturns. We talk about the four D's, and we've actually added two more. So maybe the six D's, which is death, dislocation, downsize, divorce, or, and this is the positive side, diamonds and diapers. Like, if you get married or you have babies, you're probably, you got transition in your life, you're using storage as well. So in historical downturns, people have transition, it creates demand for the asset class. The asset class usually does pretty well. And then to your point, people just don't get rid of stuff. The data in our facilities is essentially 13 months. If you stay longer than 13 months, we got you to almost 3 years, because it's just auto bill. It sticks on your card. When we do rental rate increases, for the most part, they're very small, right? So if you're paying $100 a month and we raise your rent 6%, well, that sounds like a lot, but it's $6 a month or $72 a year. Are you going to rent a U-Haul truck and go get all your stuff out and move it down the road for $72?
Yeah.
Probably not. So it's just a sticky asset class. And to your point with America, we're not good at throwing things out, and people just hang on to junk. I'll tell you a funny story if you want to hear it. It's a quick one. So one of our investors lived in Boulder, and he moved to Maui to buy a tour company. He was actually an attorney, but like an eco tour company. And the plan originally was to be out there like 2 years. So they put all their stuff in storage, rented their house in Boulder, moved to Maui. And it ended up being 10 years, and they bought a few more touring companies, and then they moved back to Boulder. And all their stuff was still in storage, and they went back to their house, and his wife opened up the storage units and was like, well, we can't use any of this furniture.
Oh my God. So
he had spent 10 years, and I think the number was something like $37,000, to store all this junk or furniture stuff. I shouldn't say junk, their house. And then when they came back, his wife was like, oh no, no, we got to get all new furniture. So, you know, his investment with us was a bid to try to recoup some of the losses spent on storage over that 10-year period. But, you know, those stories are endless. Like, it just happens.
What's the craziest thing you guys have ever found in one of your storage units?
I mean, anything. This is a family show. So anything that has human beings do is happening in self-storage. So, you know, there's been stories of brothels being run out of self-storage, meth labs, dead people. They live there. I mean, look, we have 60,000 units. So, you know, all swaths of the population. And you just get, unfortunately, some people that are down on their luck and doing some things that you'd prefer they're not doing in your storage facility. But the best story I heard, this was not at ours, is there was a gentleman who was suffering from dementia, and he had cash in duffel bags of like $900,000-ish. Wow. And put it in his storage unit and stopped paying his bill. And if you guys have ever seen the show Storage Wars, what happens when you don't pay your bill is we overlock your unit and then we auction it. Now, you can't go in and see what's in the unit. They just open the door, take pictures, and it's legal. Like, legally, you can't go in and poke around. So this particular unit got sold for $1,200 or whatever it was. And the guy who bought it got $900,000 in cash. Now, the family came back to him and they said they worked it out. I don't know what that means.
Yeah.
That guy now owned $900,000 of cash in his storage unit. So, you know,
he didn't know there was $900,000 of cash in there when he
saw it, like the couches. He was like, all right, I can sell that on eBay and Craigslist. And he said, I'll give you $1,200. He wins the bid. He gets the unit. He goes in and roots around it, what's actually there, and found cash in duffel bags.
That's hilarious.
Now,
hey, how do you,
for you and I, it is not for the family.
How do you guys identify properties? And I mean, I know there's a long process, but I mean, do you look at certain areas of the country? Are you concentrating certain areas? What is the Reliant process
for? Yeah. So we, Eric, have just under 100 properties across 9 states. Most of them are here in the Southeast. I'm talking to you from our office in Roswell, Georgia. We're just north of Atlanta, but the majority of our portfolio is North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Florida, Alabama, Tennessee. And then we just bought our first property in the state of Indiana, and we have a small portfolio in Colorado. From our perspective, the Southeast has really strong demographic trends. So we'll continue to build around that. How we underwrite is we start with the market. And storage is specific in that it's very micro market. So we used to look at the 1, 3, and 5 mile radius around the facility. Now we look at kind of drive times, because in some of our markets, 5 miles might be like 15, 20 minutes. You're probably not going to drive that. Mm-hmm. But remember, storage has to be convenient to work or home. Like, there's no amenities or school district or something you're driving to it for. You're not going to pass 3 or 4 other storage facilities to get to ours, even if ours is nicer, because it's a garage. So what we're trying to understand is the addressable market that our facility can serve and who are the competitors in that space. And then we're digging into the demographics there, like population growth, job growth. You know, are they people that we think are good storage tenants? And on the competitive set, understanding where their rates are. Like, generally, if their rates are really high, it means there's high demand in the market. If their rates are low, it means demand's low or there's a lot of excess supply. So we kind of start with the market and then move to we're underwriting the deal itself. But I would say our acquisitions team spends the most time on the market and do we want to be there?
That makes sense. We'll end off on investing in general, because look, I deal with a lot of people in the healthcare space. They know how to be practitioners. When it comes to investing though, I mean, it's the fear of missing out, things that you've seen work for the last 35 years, you know, may not necessarily be the place that you want to invest in the next 20 years. I try to start most people with like, you need to have some kind of an investment policy. I mean, I've seen big organizations and corporations, I mean, they all start with a document that says this is how we're going to invest. These are some of the do's and the don'ts. And it seems to like at least set the parameters so that it doesn't mean there's not going to be mistakes made. It doesn't mean that they're not going to be malinvestments, but it limits the, I think the downside of where a lot of investors get in trouble, which is of course over speculating and as opposed to investing. Talk to me a little bit about, I don't know, your own personal investment philosophy, you know, where it came from and what you think about what I just said.
Have you heard of Bitcoin? Put it all into crypto, baby. Real estate.
I was going to go buy some today.
It's time. It's time for crypto.
You ready?
I mean, look, Eric, to the investment thesis, I love that idea of a buy box, right? Mm. Something that fits with what you are trying to do. You know, and I'll use Reliant as an example. We're not a great cash flow investment. So if you're a practitioner who's trying to leave their job and you're trying to replace income, Reliant isn't a good bet. Like there are other opportunities that you can get current yield from. And Eric, certainly, you know, even risk-free yield, like 5% today is not
awful. T-bills.
T-bills. So I think you have to think about what that money is slotted for. Is this an appreciation play or a cash flow play? Mm-hmm. And then what is your box? What are your rules? And it helps you filter out a lot of the noise. If you say like, does it do this? No. Okay. It's out. I'm not going to look at it anymore, even if it sounds sexy. I think that's the big piece for me is just having clarity as to what you're trying to accomplish. And it changes right over time. You know, I'm 44 or 43. When I'm 53, my thesis will be different because I'm trying to do different stuff. So I think that's the other piece is really understanding what you're investing for. And then what I would layer over the whole thing is you got to think long term, right? Where people get in trouble is the get rich quick, whatever's real estate, crypto, you know, stock market trades, day trade. Like it's hard to make get rich quick money. Has it happened? For sure. Is there are there people who are going to benefit from it? Did you watch Dumb Money, the movie about GameStop?
Is that on Netflix?
No, I don't think it's there yet. It was in the theaters. It's really good. It's the story of the GameStop stock run up.
Mm.
It's interesting story, but those are once in a lifetime type of things and tough to reproduce. I like the idea of, you know, you think about Warren Buffett, it's don't lose principal.
Yeah.
And don't lose principal.
Don't lose principal. I'm actually reading. I have the book over there, The Intelligent Investor, Benjamin Graham. And, you know, I mean, some of the first things he says, he defines is the difference between investing and speculating. And I don't think that people know the difference nowadays between the two.
Yeah, and, I think you got to think long term in real estate. Like I said, everything's a good deal in 20 years. Ignore the cycle that's right in front of you and try to look to that next one. Like, okay, 10 years from now, is this story still going to make sense? Mm-hmm. I think if you can approach it that way, you're much more apt not to make a big mistake.
Yeah, for sure. And public securities is not your thing. Marketable securities is not your thing.
I'm probably not going to align with you on that. I mean, my opinion is in the public markets, the rules are different for schmucks like you and me, institutional investors, you know, high frequency traders. The rules, the information is not equal. When guys like Ray Dalio are saying, you can't beat me, I have the smartest minds in the world who work for my hedge fund, and the stock market's net zero sum game, right? Someone's going to win and someone's going to lose. I'm betting that Ray's going to win and I'm not. So I'm in my public markets exposure, I think of it as index funds, Vanguard, super low fees, hang on forever. But I also invest in what I know, Eric, which is real estate, right? And
yep.
I understand the risks and I have more control, at least in my head. So that always makes more sense to me.
No, and I'm actually probably more in your court than you think, you know, even though, you know, we are a investment advisor, you know, we do, you know, direct people's investments and, you know, I am not one of those guys that has like a, not necessarily a bias towards anything, but like for instance, I know that public securities probably has a fit for some people. They've known them, they're comfortable with them for a piece of their portfolio. Same with even like insurance-based products. I mean, I've saved people, I can't tell you how much money and created guaranteed income streams and such by intelligently using insurance-based products. And then obviously within the same thing with real estate. So I think, but at the end of the day, most of your money is going to be generated through your business ownership and your real estate ownership, at least if you're a practice owner.
Sure.
And that's where probably 70% of your wealth should be concentrated on and really trying to focus on building a better business. And or even you know, like we talked about earlier, even buying a business or another practice to add on to what you have right now, because that if you can do that, which is not an easy thing to do, but you know some of these bigger corporations are paying, you know, huge multiples for practices that you know have significant cash flow and multiple practitioners and all those things. So anyway, yeah,
I like the idea of concentrated bets to create wealth, mm-hmm. right? So like you mentioned, maybe you're a PT, right? And you build up a monster physical therapy practice. Well, that's a concentrated bet to create your wealth. Then once you create it, you diversify it to keep it, right? And once you have the chunk of money, then the idea is, all right, how do I get it wide so that I, you know, it's my stay rich money forever, or maybe the next generation, depending on how much money you make.
Yeah. And I mean, you guys probably deal with a lot of family offices and such. You know, I don't know that necessarily their viewpoint is, oh, let's see how much money we can make. It seems to be more of a risk management. How do we keep all of this money so that we don't lose it? You had conversations with these family offices. Is that more of their mindset than anything else?
And 100%, they care much more about number one is principal preservation. Mm-hmm. Number two is tax efficiency. They want to understand how can they be efficient with creating money. And number three is cash flow. Like appreciation is way, way down the list because they're already rich.
Yeah.
Their horizon. And this is true of some large institutional investors too, Eric. Think like university endowments. Like we met with Harvard and Yale's endowments. They have 30, I think Yale now has like 40 billion under management in their endowment. They don't need more, right? They just need to continue to appreciate off of what they already have. And so I think what most of the really high net worth investors we deal with are the ultra high net worths. The difference is their horizon is forever, not mm-hmm. 5 years. How do I turn my money? It's how do I keep my money for this generation and the next three or four? And we're investing with the idea that it has to be here in 100 years. And that's different between people like us, right? Who are much more, kind of shiny object, like, oh, I can invest
in
Bitcoin today and maybe I'll double my money tomorrow. But the
option. You've been talking an awful lot about Bitcoin today. I'm kind of thinking that you are a secret investor in Bitcoin right now and just don't want to tell anybody.
I have exposure, but let me give you my example. I knew I needed exposure in crypto. I mm-hmm. also know that I'm not smart enough to make a smart bet, right? Most people just say like, oh yeah, I'll throw some money at it. So what I did is I invested in a fund with two guys that I know. One of the guys, and I am not making this up, the guy's name is Coyn, C-O-Y-N.
Wow.
And he ran this crypto fund that he's been doing since college. He's young, he's 33, and they've crushed it. So that's how I'm getting my exposure to it, because I know those guys, like I know them personally as people first, and I know they're way down the line on the education. I don't want to learn it. I don't want to be an expert. So those guys are my crypto experts. So I have exposure to the market. I don't understand exactly what's happening, but I get a general sense.
And I think that's a good place to end off right there, folks. So, that was good. I think, you hit everything on the head. You nailed it. I appreciate you, man. And, if people want to connect with Reliant, what do they do?
Yeah. Website's probably the easiest. It's Reliant-MGMT.com. That's that's the easiest place to find us. There's contact us, invest now buttons all over the place. If you fill out your information, you can talk to our team about any of our investment opportunities, or even if you just want to learn more about self-storage, we get people to talk to you about it for sure.
Excellent. Okay, my friend, appreciate it. And everyone, thanks for listening. I'll see you guys on the next podcast.
Thanks, Eric.